Welcome to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. You might say David Blight is absorbed with the life of abolitionist Frederick Douglass. David, who's an author, teacher, and historian, has written three books about him, and his latest is called Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. It won the Pulitzer Prize for History and is now being adapted into a movie for Netflix produced by Barack and Michelle Obama. David appeared at a virtual National Writer Series event, and he spoke with author and director of arts and culture for the city of Detroit, Rochelle Riley. Rochelle asked David how he became so interested in Frederick Douglass.
How did this happen? I don't know. You know, I was in college in the late 1960s. I graduated from Michigan State in 71. I took the first ever Black History course taught at Michigan State, at least I think it was, in either 68 or 69. It was taught by Les Rout, who was African-American, although his scholarly field was Latin America and particularly the history of Brazil. But Les taught this amazing course in Black history, and frankly, none of us had ever had any. I did not have anything in a concerted way about the Black experience in high school, even though I had two great high school history teachers. And then I became a teacher in Flint, and we were all creating something called Black History courses. And frankly, without knowing what we were doing, I remember getting my school library at Flint Northern to buy multiple copies of John Hope Franklin's From Slavery to Freedom. There we had a textbook. And I remember getting them to buy multiple copies of Kenneth Stamp's The Peculiar Institution, which at that point happened to be one book I knew about slavery, even though it was published back in the 1950s. And we sort of went from there. And honest to God, I don't think I even discovered Douglass until I was a high school teacher. Back then, I even bought a poster that I still have here. It still hangs in my apartment. One of those posters you get from the Scholastic resource companies. And what I still love about it, and the reason it's framed up on the wall, is not only the photo of Douglass, which I love, but it has his wrong birth date on it, and it gives him a middle initial that he never had. So it's one of those, you know, collector's items because of the mistakes on the poster. But it was in graduate school that I locked on to Douglass. I went off to Wisconsin at that point in the late 1970s. I wanted to study abolitionism. I particularly wanted to study Black abolitionists. And quite quickly, I landed on Douglass in part because he left the most sources. He left the most writing to work with. And my dissertation, which became my first book, called Frederick Douglass's Civil War, was a work on Douglass. And I've done other things on Douglass over the years, and I had Douglass pretty much out of my life until about 14 years ago, when I went to Savannah, Georgia, to give a talk on Douglass's narrative to middle and high school teachers. And there I met the collector, Walter Evans. A chance encounter, my host introduced me to him. He took me over to his house. He showed me portions of his magnificent collection of Douglass manuscripts, which he had been collecting since the early 1980s. And it took me some time to commit to this. There wasn't just this road to Damascus moment, but that collection, which we perhaps could talk about a bit more, is the reason that I then chose to attempt a full life of Douglass. So all praise to Walter and Linda Evans, who became my patrons and my dear friends. And without that collection, I would have never written this book.
Well, I was going to ask about Walter Evans, because when you're a historian and you're someone who's mining data and looking for things, to come across someone like that is just truly amazing.
Yeah.
If you could just tell our viewers a little bit about what that was like and what it looked like when you met this man who had this amazing treasure trove.
Yes, it was extraordinary. And the collection is extraordinary. And as many people may know, if they read the New York Times, as of 2 days ago,
which I did,
it has finally been announced. That's been in the making for many, many, many months. But it has finally been announced that the Evans Douglass collection is being processed as we speak here at the Beinecke Rare Book and Manuscript Library at Yale, which is one of the world's great research libraries. It took many, many years to court Walter to sell his Douglas collection here to Yale, but it is finally here. And that, to me, is a triumph. But the collection itself is so important, and it was so important to me as a biographer, because the heart of it consists of about 9 very large family scrapbooks that were kept by Douglas's, 2 of Douglas's sons in particular. He had 4 surviving adult children. They all had a hand in these scrapbooks, but particularly Lewis and Frederick Jr. were the scrapbookers. And they, over the last 30 years of their father's life, from about the end of the Civil War to when he died, they cataloged his life and their own lives. And this treasure trove that's in these scrapbooks becomes a window into that latter third of Frederick Douglass's life like we had never had before, and into it, and into the lives of his extended family. 4 surviving children, 21 grandchildren, even some fictive siblings, and other kinds of hangers-on that were always around Douglas. The Evans collection is full of family letters, family documents, even 2 handwritten narratives by 2 of the sons about growing up in the Douglas household, which are absolute treasures for a biographer. But I think above all, it opened up this latter third of a man's life. If Americans tend to know Douglas at all, they, although they're getting to know him much better now, they tend to know the young Douglas, you know, the heroic escaped slave who wrote the famous narrative, who became a great orator even in his 20s or in his 30s. But that aging Douglas, the older man who moves to Washington, D.C., who gets 3 appointments in the federal government, who becomes a kind of political insider in the government to a degree, and in the Republican Party to an even greater degree. You know, over the years, he didn't seem as interesting to a lot of people. But to me, that almost took over the book. Turns out aging can be fascinating. And in this case, it's a man who became a patriarch of this huge family, always a struggling family, always a family with very modern conflicts. And it's the story of an old radical outsider who becomes, to some degree at least, a kind of political insider. He's really the prototype of that experience, especially for African-American leaders. And we know many other cases like that in the 20th century. So there was so much that I learned from the Evans collection that anybody that looks at the footnotes of my book will see hundreds and hundreds of citations to that collection. And I spent, I don't even know how many weeks I spent in Savannah, many spring break weeks, many other weeks, working on Linda and Walter's dining room table. I mean, it's, you mentioned what an extraordinary, you know, bit of luck this was. And it really was luck. I just happened to bump into this. I was not the first scholar to ever see Walter's collection, but I was the first to really use it. And now there are at least a couple of handfuls of other scholars who have gone to Savannah, have gone through Walter's initiations, and have spent time, a great deal of time, at the dining room table.
Well, congratulations on being the first to use it. It was used wisely. I do want us to spend some time on him as the elder statesman, but I want to start at the beginning. I can tell you, when I got this assignment from the National Writers Series, I immediately picked up and reread the first book, The Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, one of his 3 autobiographies, because I wanted his voice in my head. As it turns out, I didn't need to do that, because you describe the book as a biography of a voice, and his voice is throughout this entire volume. Mm. How important was that to you, and why did you choose to do it that way? Because it's not a chronological, just, you know, standard bare obituary or biography. It's an examination of different times where his voice spoke in different ways. How did you come to that?
Well, I love that question, Rochelle, because it was the voice I was not only trying to capture, but it is the most important thing about Douglas. Douglas was a man of words, a creature of words, a genius with language. We wouldn't be here talking about him if it weren't for the millions, literally millions of words that he wrote. He wrote 1,200 pages of autobiography. He wrote hundreds and hundreds of the short form political editorials. He mastered that form. He wrote one novella in the early 1850s called The Heroic Slave, and would that he had found time to perhaps write more fiction, although some have claimed that any great autobiographer is already writing, to a degree, fiction. And then there are the thousands of speeches for which in some ways he's most famous. You know, millions of words. And I should say too here, though he was first an orator, he was first a craftsman of the spoken word, he became a writer. It wasn't right away. I mean, writing was not simple for him. This is a man, of course, with no formal education, none. He's not entirely self-taught. He had mentors, he had teachers, but not in any schoolroom anytime in his life. But he, I think, in the end, was most self-conscious that he became a creature of the pen. And it was the power of the pen, the power of words, that he came to understand were his only real weapon. It's the only real power he ever really had. So I actually at one point wanted to make the title of the book, Frederick Douglass, Biography of a Voice. But my editor quite wisely probably said, no, can't do that. Sounds too literary, you know, you'll confuse your reader. But in a sense, that is what it became. Now, the risk there, of course, is you could have a biography that just catalogs Douglass's words over and over and over. And you can't do that either. But the trick was always weaving in Douglass's words, whether they're retrospective words in autobiography or whether they're actual letters or actual speeches, at the same time telling the chronological story of his life and telling about the times, the incredibly turbulent times in which he lived and on which he had tremendous impact.
Well, you're talking about his voice, and I'm hoping to give readers and to give viewers and all those people who are going to buy the book after this conversation just a glimpse into his voice. And I wanted to ask if you would read something that is so powerful from his early life. It's on page 47, The Silver Trump of Knowledge, and it speaks to him sort of being unforgettably eloquent about his circumstance.
Now, this comes in the moment in the narrative, the first autobiography. He's only 27 years old, remembering his achievement of literacy, and yet he does it so honestly. He says, you know, my literacy caused tremendous discontent, tremendous fear. What was I going to do with all this literacy? How could I use it? He even says at one point, I envied my more ignorant fellow slaves their ignorance. But then he floats into this passage, which is the one I think you wanted me to read. I have often wished myself a beast, he says. I preferred the condition of the meanest reptile to my own. Anything, no matter what, to get rid of thinking. It was this everlasting thinking of my condition that tormented me. There was no getting rid of it. It pressed upon me by every object within sight or hearing, animate or inanimate. The silver trump of freedom had aroused my soul to eternal wakefulness. Freedom now appeared to disappear no more forever. It was heard in every sound and seen in everything. It was ever present to torment me with a sense of my wretched condition. I saw nothing without seeing it. I heard nothing without hearing it and felt nothing without feeling it. It looked from every star. It smiled in every calm, it breathed in every wind, and moved in every storm. That's the torment of beginning to know what freedom might be, but not being able to attain it. It's the discovery of what liberation of the mind might be, but not being able to reach it. This is one section. Well, there's so many, but it's one section where we can truly hear him as a prose poet. This is poetry in the form of prose, and several times in the book, I call Douglass the prose poet of American democracy.
Absolutely apt. And this is one of the most powerful passages in American literature that I can remember. So I was glad to see it in your book.
Yeah.
There are dozens, literally dozens and dozens and dozens of tingle-producing discoveries that you present in the book. Some of them appear briefly like shooting stars, but are powerful, and some are of great magnitude, such as Douglas learning after his mother's death that she could read, or his paying $1.50 poll tax to register to vote,
right,
either 1839 or 1840. How did you decide which details to include, or did you just include everything?
That's a great question. No, I did not include everything, but the longer this book became, there are a lot of them there. We had some battles about length. The Evans collection was itself a tremendous source of anecdotes, new facts, new moments, sometimes just little narrative moments. That discovery of the poll tax, they're paying that tax to register to vote within 1 year, probably, of his escape from slavery, was actually mentioned first in another book. But I went to the New Bedford City Hall and looked it all up, and there was his name, Frederick Douglass.
Wow.
$1.50. He registered to vote. He was 21 years old. There are many, many others. Sometimes they were just realizations of where he was at a given time, of who he would meet. Sometimes they were just moments of humor, of almost comic relief in this life of unrelenting encounters with racism. He got Jim Crowed more times than he could ever count.
And I love that verb. Every time I read that, I said, I have to use that.
Yeah, well, he did. He got Jim Crowed in restaurants, on trains, on riverboats, on steamers, in taverns and so on. And one of the ways he survived all of this is that as he got a little older anyway, he would begin to process some of it by humor. I mean, to survive. There's a case in the book I used, I had even more than one of these, where he gets Jim Crowed in a restaurant, part of a hotel. It's after the Civil War. He's out in the Midwest. I forget where now, Michigan, maybe Iowa, maybe, I don't remember. But he gets Jim Crowed. The manager won't sit him in the dining room. And he says, sorry, sir, you can't eat here. You'll have to eat in the kitchen. And I got this out of a newspaper, a clipping in the Evans collection. And Douglas apparently stood up in the middle of the restaurant in his booming voice and said, where do the dogs eat? Show me your dogs. I'll eat with your dogs. And pretty soon, all the patrons in the restaurant are on his side. They have sympathy for him, and they're all on their feet saying, no, sit the man with us. Let him eat. Those kinds of little anecdotes are what actually make a good story. They make good biographical moments. I'll give you one other one that I found in a clipping in the Evans collection that I am so fond of. He's in Iowa City. I remember this one. It's 1869, because I know the speech he had just given was a bit of a dud. This was the year he was trying to do history speeches, and they didn't always work. And he's sitting in the train station looking dead tired, which is entirely believable, and a reporter for a Milwaukee newspaper comes up to him and says, Mr. Douglas, so honored to see you. Your speech last night, it didn't seem to be you. You didn't seem to have it. And Douglas's response, according to the reporter, was, well, you know, if I really belted out like I used to, I have false teeth now and I'd lose my teeth.
You just took my kicker.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I'm telling it, so I didn't want to stop you. It's my favorite passage in the book as a
Oh, my God. But you know, it didn't end there, as you probably remember. Because then the reporter asks him, so, Mr. Douglas, what's the hardest part of being out on these endless speaking tours? And Douglas's response was, having to talk to people like you.
Which I've heard many times.
I bet you have. As a journalist, you've had to endure that one, I'm sure. Anyway, it's that kind of stuff that you get out of, especially newspaper clippings, that help you tell a story. There are more important facts in this book that were new, especially about his relationships with his sons, his two wives, other people in his life. Lots of new revelations here about friendships, rivalries, and the like.
Well, I can tell you the book is not just an examination of his life and his voice, but a retelling of his autobiographies and filling in history and detail that has not been seen or explored so deeply. So this is going to be a long question. We're talking about details of his preaching, the first time a white abolitionist reached out, the many people who tried to take credit for discovering him, being the only African-American at the Seneca Falls Women's Suffrage Convention, his meeting Harriet Beecher Stowe right after the successful publication of Uncle Tom's Cabin, meeting John Brown before the Harper's Ferry raid and deciding at the last minute not to accompany him to certain death, the many different ways he found to advance his intellectual prowess, his unusual household with his wife and another woman, meeting Booker T. Washington, meeting James Weldon Johnson. There was so, meeting Ida B. Wells, my heroine and hero.
Oh, yeah.
So talk about what it felt like to, I mean, he is the exact opposite of incidental, so you can't liken him to Forrest Gump, but he is a part of every major historical event for almost a century. Mm-hmm. What was that like to find all of those different things and write about them the way that you did?
Well, first of all, he did tend to meet everybody of importance, especially from the Civil War on. And he had a particularly acute problem with fame, what we would call celebrity today. They didn't use that word in the 19th century. It's like the word racism. They didn't really use that word in the 19th century, although they meant the same thing. Douglas had a serious problem with fame. He couldn't go anywhere. He was so visible. Part of this was because of how many photographs had been taken of him. This was a stunning young man, and he worked carefully on that hair, I can assure you. So his visage, his visual presence was part of his fame, but that's only one small part of it. The fame was really rooted in the oratory and the writing. His autobiographies, the first and second, sold very, very well. In fact, they were bestsellers by 19th century standards. And his oratory, you know, his speeches are impossible to even count. He would go on lecture tours of 3 and 4 months at a time and deliver a lecture at least every other day for years on end. And it became a kind of an American phenomenon to see Douglas. You go hear Douglas, you know, Elvis was in town or whomever, you know, Beyonce was in town. Maybe that's stretching a 21st century analogy too far. But he does meet all of these people at different stages of his life, and they know they are meeting this person of great symbolism. But if he met you, he'd figure out, what can I learn from you? And sometimes when he thought he had learned all he could, he kind of discarded people, which doesn't always build great, you know, relationships over time. But he was a learner from people.
I noticed that throughout the book, and it was amazing that people still loved him, even though he no longer had use for them.
He was not always easy to get along with. He was a very sensitive, hypersensitive guy.
As we face the greatest revolution since the civil rights rebellions of the 60s and maybe the Civil War itself, we have to look back at Abraham Lincoln, whom Douglas had this love, you know, hate. Every now and again, they'd get mad relationship. Mm-hmm. Lincoln blamed the war on black people, saying, but for your race among us, there could not be war. And he invited black people to leave and form their own colony elsewhere. How we wish for Douglas's words now, or someone who rose to that level to speak about these things. But with his voice in your head and his history in your rear view, what do you think will happen in America next? And would Frederick Douglass have foreseen it? I know you've been asked numerous times, what would Frederick Douglass say? Because you know him, his voice. But
that's of course difficult and impossible, but unavoidable these days. We don't know what Douglas would do now. He might just come to us and say, you know, I died 130 some years ago and you all are still at this, for God's sake, you know. On the other hand, he might not be that surprised, because Douglas came to view history in the long view. He really did. And he had encountered many ups and far more downs in the trajectory of black freedom, black civil and political rights, dignity, acceptance of their humanity, and so on. I think Douglas, if he were around today, what we would hope he would do, what we would most want from him, is what he gave the 19th century, and that is a prophetic voice. A prophetic voice in the sense that, and I struggled in this book for quite a long time about whether to use that word prophet on Douglas, because that's a big word.
Yes.
And I learned you don't throw that word around softly. But some theologian friends of mine helped me with a lot of theological reading, and I finally got comfortable with it because I came to learn from theologians like Walter Brueggemann and Abraham Heschel that especially in the tradition of the Hebrew prophets, which Douglas read so closely, a prophet is that person who somehow finds the words, the language, to capture our experience for us that we can't quite capture on our own. Or as Abraham Heschel said, the true prophet can hear words and use them one octave higher than the rest of us can hear. They find the language to explain a catastrophe, to explain a pivot in history, you know, a reckoning like we're having now. And do we ever yearn now for someone like a king? Yeah, maybe like a Du Bois, like somebody, and Douglas, to step in and say, all right, here's how this fits in our history. Here's how this finds a place in what has come before. It is not entirely new. Yes, it is new in some ways, but it is not entirely new. And if you don't keep a long view, you may all but kill yourselves in trying to deal with this situation. It's that kind of prophetic voice that we would hope for from Douglas. I also think if he were around, he'd probably want to go harness those protests. He'd want to harness young people. He'd encourage them. And he'd want to harness them into politics. Douglas was all about the right to vote. Some even said he overstressed the right to vote over against other kinds of economic issues and economic liberty. But he would be trying to harness this incredible fervor right now into voting, into new coalitions that would truly transform not just the law, but the society.
Well, I think we've learned that he was not wrong, that economics and power and everything comes with the vote. Thank you so much. This was my honor to talk to you.
Rochelle, no, it was my honor. This was a great pleasure. I wish we had another hour.
We would need another five, Professor.
Okay, well, next time in Traverse City or Detroit. Next time in Detroit.
Here's the book. Okay. Do not miss it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, everybody. Thanks, Rochelle.
That was David Blight talking with Rochelle Riley, and you're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up in the second half, a discussion with Miles Harvey, author of a new book about the King of Beaver Island.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Have you heard of the King of Beaver Island? In the second half of our program today, we'll hear a discussion with Miles Harvey, who will tell you all about him. Miles' latest book is called The King of Confidence, and it's about James Strang, who founded an offshoot Mormon colony on the island after the death of founder Joseph Smith. Miles Harvey appeared at a virtual National Writer Series event and talked with fellow author Jeremiah Chamberlain. Jeremiah asked Miles to tell him how he came to write this book.
Well, I think the first time I heard about James Strang, I was in Burlington, Wisconsin, which is a little town about 2 hours north of Chicago. My brother-in-law, Chris Carr, grew up there. And we started driving around town one day, I don't know, 20 years ago, Jeremy. And Chris started pointing to old buildings and telling me about this story of a Mormon utopian colony that had existed in this little town in Wisconsin. And of course, this was the town Strang had occupied before moving to Beaver Island. Well, I didn't really think about the story that much. I mean, I was really interested in it, but I don't know, about 6 years ago, I got, I guess, a call or an email from my agent saying an editor at Little Brown, a big New York publishing house, wants to talk to you. And I was, of course, interested. And it was this guy, Ben George, who's been a wonderful collaborator. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, I know your work and I'm thinking that you might want to consider doing a book on Strang. And of course, I was a little skeptical because I didn't come up with the idea, but I quickly realized not only that I really wanted to do this book, but that I sort of knew how I wanted to do it. And so things just went from there.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe before we go any further, we can meet James Strang. Maybe you'd be willing to read just a little bit from the beginning of the book to give us that sense of this individual's character, and then we can
That sounds great. So, although James Jesse Strang was physically unimposing, a few inches over 5 feet and bald, with an oddly bulging forehead, he did possess one distinguishing feature, his dark brown eyes, which one acquaintance described as rather small but very bright and piercing, giving an extremely animated expression to his whole countenance. Another claimed that those eyes seemed, quote, as though they could bore right through a person. But more than any tangible attribute, Strang possessed an invisible, ineffable aura called confidence. And in those days, before electrical power, confidence was what made antebellum America hum. Confidence was black magic, good fortune, and hard cash combined. Confidence could turn worthless paper into glittering gold, cow towns into cities, empty lots into bustling businesses, losers into winners, paupers into millionaires. Confidence was a charm deployed by bankers and merchants, philosophers and politicians, clergymen and card sharps alike. Confidence was the soul of trade, in the words of a leading financial publication. Without it, added Herman Melville, commerce between man and man, as between country and country, would run down and stop. In an age before the federal government began printing paper money, an age when people had to trust in privately issued banknotes, glorified IOUs, confidence was the de facto national currency.
Great. Let's talk a little bit more about that, Miles, that idea of confidence. I really enjoyed the, and congratulations again on the marvelous review in the New York Times this morning. I thought that reviewer got it right, concluding that review with thinking about the way in which this is, on one hand, a story of Strang, and I want to come back and talk about Strang more and all the particular events that took place nearby in Beaver Island and elsewhere. But it really is about this sort of moment in history, this moment where the confidence man arose. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that concept or what was sort of happening in the mid-1800s that gave rise to it, and how Strang is in many ways really a product of his time.
Yeah, I mean, this time period, like ours, was a time in which everyday reality, truth, was very much in flux. It was a time of massive change, social, economic, technological, huge communications revolution, and people did not feel that they could hold on to the old things that they'd been holding on to. And so confidence in another person, hey, Jeremy, I feel confident that I can tell you this, became really important. And so someone like Strang, who had this ability to attract confidence, was able to sort of bend the truth his way.
Well, let's talk a little bit also about what else is sort of shaping this period at the time, because you have this moment of opportunity. You also have a moment of idealism. You've got utopianists out there. I was really struck by the constellation of characters that you bring into this book. You bring in Nathaniel Hawthorne, who, though I've read, you know, a number of Hawthorne's books over the years, I actually didn't realize or know anything about the many, many years he spent as a part of a utopian community. You bring in all these abolition movement people. So you've got Strang as this sort of gravitational force, but you've got all these other people orbiting, sometimes crossing paths, sometimes not. What else was in the air, so to speak, besides this?
Well, I mean, there was craziness in the air. There were all these, what we might now call, in some cases, religious cults. There was spiritualism, table rapping, you know. But there were also all these exciting new religions, Mormonism among them. But this was also the time when, you know, the abolition movement really picks up steam, and when the women's movement gets started. It was just a really exciting time in American history. And, you know, I did see Strang as kind of this lightning rod for that whole period. I mean, he just had his sort of hands in so many of these things, including abolition. And we can talk about that later, but he's just a really interesting three-dimensional figure.
Well, let's take a step back then, because I do want to talk about the sort of larger plot of the book and some of the goings on. And there's a lot of people in the audience obviously have this personal connection to this place. And I'll also say that there are a number of books that have been written about Strang over the years, both fiction and nonfiction. So how did you make this book your own? How did you find the story that you wanted to really tell here? From all that, I mean, you have almost 70 pages of notes and a bibliography in the back, which I found almost as fascinating as the book itself. But tell us about your story of Strang, Miles.
Well, as you said, there have been several good books about Strang already. There's three of them that I particularly admire. But I think mostly those books sort of focused on Strang as a Mormon footnote to Mormon history, or Strang as a Michigan story or a Midwestern story. One of those books is called Assassination of a Michigan King. I saw Strang as this lightning rod for all the fevers of the time. And it kind of just went from there. And I think for your audience that knows this story, I mean, I think in some ways Strang's like Johnny Appleseed or Paul Bunyan, right? Everybody in the Midwest has kind of maybe heard of him, but certainly in Michigan and Northern Michigan. But I think I added some new research to his story, both good and bad. So good, Strang was an abolitionist. We knew that. I think I traced some of his roots as an abolitionist and his firsthand encounter with slavery that really had a decisive effect on him. I say in the book, like, Strang didn't believe in a lot of things firmly. He was both for and against polygamy. We could go on from there, but he consistently acted on behalf of the rights of African Americans, both within the church, which was really progressive at that time, and as a legislator in Michigan. But I also found some new bad stuff about him. I mean, he has long been accused of running a pirate colony out of Ireland. And some people deny that that happened. There were tons of press reports about it at the time. But I pinned down more about that. For instance, there was a situation in Perrysburg, Ohio, where in real time in 1853, one of Strang's top lieutenants gets arrested for horse theft, which was a huge crime then. Strang comes to town. Somebody gets bribed. There's a jailbreak. And Strang is there, and people are writing about it at the time. So I think I added a little bit to the picture of Strang, and he's just a fascinating figure to me.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the most surprising things you came across? I mean, you've had a little background, you were approached about this project, but what just really kind of sent you across the room to say, oh, you've got to hear about this, or oh, this is what an amazing detail?
Well, I mean, the story is just, when I tell people about it, I use the phrase, I am not making this up. I mean, many of your listeners will know some of the basic stories. Strang started this He was kind of a failure in Western New York as a lawyer, a newspaper editor, and a postmaster. Moved out to what was then the West, the wilds of Wisconsin, and sort of remade himself. And he'd been an atheist his whole life, but he went to Nauvoo, which was the big Mormon capital city at that time on the Mississippi, and converted to Mormonism. And then Joseph Smith was killed just months later, and suddenly Strang was claiming to be Smith's handpicked successor. And eventually Strang just drew a big group of people around him, and eventually they moved to Beaver Island. I was just surprised by his intelligence, but also just his complexity. As I say, you know, this abolitionist side of him, I mean, he certainly wasn't the only abolitionist in the mid-1850s, but when he was in the Michigan legislature, he kind of voted against his own party. He was a Democrat, and even when the new Republican Party came in, he voted with them, and fellow Democrats didn't like that, to sort of nullify in Michigan the Fugitive Slave Act, which was, of course, was a very controversial law that made people release slaves in the North. And so I just found many aspects of him surprising.
Mm-hmm. I was just fascinated by the level of research you did in this book and all of the stories that are sort of circulating around Strang, orbiting around Strang. And I wonder, I mean, there must have been so many more you couldn't even include in here, right? I mean, how does one research not just an individual within a movement, within a particular place, within a community, but within a larger era of all these competing influences? How does one find a narrative in that too? Because one of the things I really admired about the book is that it reads in many ways like a novel. There are plot twists, there's drama, there's great characterization, and it feels at times like I never would think to myself, oh, I'm reading a research or a nonfiction book. I really felt like this marvelous story you've created. How do you curate or find the pathway through so much work?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, Jeremy, you and I were on a panel together, I don't know, or so a year or so ago. One of the things I do is keep this massive timeline. So I think my timeline for this book, which is just this happened on this date, this happened on this date, this happened on this date, I think it was 250 plus pages, just the timeline. But what that timeline allows me to do is figure out what's happening both in Strang's life and in the world. And you make a lot of discoveries about both of them. You know, I also benefited from a revolution in digital newspaper libraries with 19th century newspapers. Over the past 5 years or 10 years, they've gotten really good. And I had access to information that other researchers, earlier researchers, as great as they were, simply didn't have access to. Mm. So that was really a helpful thing. And then, you know, I mean, I think I pride myself as a storyteller. I mean, I think finding a way to introduce this complicated material that's happening all at once, sort of piece by piece, and think it through, you know, chapter by chapter, is something I really have with.
Mm-hmm. Are you a hard person to live with when you're in the middle of a book?
Oh man, you know, years ago, my wife pointed out that I'm always in a bad mood when I'm writing. And I think it's because I'm such a slow writer, you know, like I think we think of brooding as something bad and writing as something good, but really for me, they're like the same. So when I'm like spending 20 minutes on the same verb, you know, and just these repeated thoughts in my head, these things that in any other context would be really bad, right? Like, oh, that sentence is running over and over in this terribly troubled person's mind. Well, yeah, but that's just my life. And I, you know, I wish I were a faster writer, but it's just the way I am. So yeah, I'm not, I don't know. You know, I think I have this little basement office, and my family is kind enough to just kind of let me go down here and be an idiot.
Uh-huh. Every once in a while, knock on the door to make sure you're all right.
Yeah, it's kind of like that.
But you know, speaking of your wife, you have an interesting connection there too, right? Because she did the audio version of the book.
Yeah, that was a real blast. You know, my wife, Rangan Altai, is a wonderful Chicago actress and has done all sorts of work in stage and TV and screen and commercials. And she's done another audio book for Little Brown, Scott Blackwood's wonderful novel by Scott Blackwood. But she did this book, and you know, we've never really collaborated before, but I was just listening to it today, and I was like, you are good. So that was really fun to collaborate with her a little bit. Mostly
she just went off and did her thing and said, leave me alone. I'm a professional. But it was really fun to work with her.
That was your collaboration?
Kind of. But I mean, it was fun to sit around the dinner table and say, you know, what was your intention with this sentence in a way that you usually do?
So. Oh, for inflection, like hearing the voice. Yeah.
That's
interesting. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. Let's take a step back. I mean, you mentioned technology earlier, both in the ability to access archives and things like that that you couldn't have before. But I was also really struck so many times reading this book, Miles, by the way in which it felt like it could be written about today in certain ways. The story feels so relevant in the contemporary moment. In the 1850s, you've got the telegraph is happening, and you've got newspapers are allowed to send one copy to all other newspapers, sort of a analog worldwide web, at least between publishers. So there's this enormous dissemination of news, which Strang used to his benefit, right? Taking his own newspaper and then seeding these stories about himself around the world. But I also feel like we're in the midst of another tech communication revolution that feels like we're a little behind the curve, or at least maybe I just feel that way, that I wonder what sort of parallels you're seeing in terms of the way in which technology and communication technology specifically is being used today and some of the echoes that maybe felt almost still strangely prescient.
I think technology, one of the things I realized is that Strang was really, as you said, ahead of his time. He understood that because he had been two things, a postmaster and an editor, he understood how, and it's a little complicated to explain, but how news moved in the mid-19th century. And it was really not unlike a sort of rudimentary version of the information superhighway. And he realized brilliantly that he could not only create news from Beaver Island and get it out nationwide and sometimes worldwide, but he could also control the news from this isolated place. And, you know, I'm struck in thinking about con men. I just did a piece for the Wall Street Journal about other books about con men. There was a guy named John Brinkley who famously convinced thousands of American men to have goat gonads inserted into their bodies to restore their virility. But he was a brilliant innovator in this new technology of radio. And I think now we have a similar thing where, you know, Russian troll farms can affect the US election, or at least try to affect it. And so I think when truth is kind of slippery, people like this can really come in and have a big influence.
That's terrific. We talked about the unique moment of this time. We talked about some of the unique technology happening in this time. I was also really struck, you meditated in interesting ways on islands. And I'm wondering what you think about, or whether you think this story would have or could have happened in the same way if it weren't in this sort of both isolated and connected sphere of Beaver Island.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think there are two things to think about islands. I wrote about islands in my first book, which is about maps, and I'm pretty fascinated by islands. I mean, I think in one way, there's just like this strategic advantage for Strang, right? I mean, when he had this colony in Wisconsin, you know, his enemies would come to town and stick around, and his followers would get bored and leave. Well, Beaver Island was much better for that, and it was also much better for his criminal enterprises. But I also think islands just have this place in our imagination where people can become new beings on island. And this goes all the way from, you know, early mythology to Darwin, you know? And so there's this idea that you can create yourself all over and that you can invent new rules. I mean, there's a reason that Thomas More's Utopia is on an island. And Beaver Island, those who've been there, there is a kind of magical way the light hangs over the island. And it is kind of a magical place. And I could see people coming there for the first time, as long as they were coming in summer, really digging the place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you mentioned, I think, also seeing utopias side by side with places like this, which was obviously in Strang's point of view, a utopic kind of project in certain ways, it seems. Miles, how do you navigate that? On the one hand, we often think of confidence men in this sort of cynical way. And yet, do you also see him as this sort of idealistic character? I mean, how do you read between the lines through all your research of that.
I mean, I think both those aspects of him are there. One of the things we're lucky enough to have with Strang is his diaries from the time he's about, I don't know, 18 or 19 to 23, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we see both sides of him in those. I mean, he's really interested in utopian thought, but he also is really cynical, and he really realizes he can manipulate people. At one point, he talks about how, hey, I'm an atheist secretly, but I'm really good about talking about religion, and people get really jazzed up when they hear me talk about religion. So I think there were both those things for him. And as far as whether he believed his own story, you know, I don't think we have an answer to that. I think it's quite possible, and I would probably say I think the current president has this ability to, on the one hand, know you're lying, and on the other hand, thinking that lie is vital because you are a special chosen person and that you have a privilege to lie that other people don't have. And I think there was probably something like that with Strang. That's just my instinct. That's not based on, you know, absolute evidence.
Interesting. Describe for me the perfect actor cast in this film for you.
Made
Strang's life
into
a movie.
18-year-old son Julian gets credit for this one. It would be Jared Leto. I was asked by one newspaper to come up with a casting for Strang, and my son said, there's only one guy. But I mean, if you look at the two noses on these guys, those close-set eyes and their sort of crazy charisma, I mean, I just think, man, you got to do that. But no one's asked me so far about who should cast in my non-existent movie.
Yeah. Well, on that note too, Miles, did you ever consider making this into fiction or film? I mean, I know you're somebody who obviously narrative matters, story matters to you, but did you ever consider the possibility of turning this into a novel since so much of it reads novelistically?
I mean, I think there are some other interesting novels about Strang. I think that this story is stranger than fiction. I think there's ways in which writing about Strang would be unbelievable as fiction. As far as a film goes, I mean, I gotta say, Vanity Fair said it was something like ripe for a motion picture treatment. Mm-hmm. And this is the only book I've ever written that I thought would actually make a good movie. So if any of you are out there with a lot of production money,
feel free to be in touch.
Yeah, feel free to be in touch.
Okay, that's great. So thank you all for coming. It's been a marvelous conversation. And thank you, Miles. It was terrific as always. I hope to
thank
see you.
Thank you, Jeremy. And thank you to NWS. And thank you to everyone who tuned in tonight.
That was Miles Harvey talking with Jeremiah Chamberlain. Miles Harvey's latest book is The King of Confidence. In the first half of the program, we heard from David Blight talking with Rochelle Riley. David's latest book is Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org and listen to past programs at interlockinpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Milcarrick.